understanding of House Bill 264 is that you're diverting funds from one fund source to address another problem area, which contains the underground tanks. What happens if the money is used up for primarily the intent of oil spill cleanups? What happens if the money is used up and there's no funds to be used? The other question that I have is, why not set up another mechanism to do the underground storage tanks, utilizing gas tax or something?
Mr. Chairman, Representative McLean, is your first question, what happens if we have an emergency and the spill reserve is not sufficient? I believe the governor is, in that situation, authorized to use any available funds necessary to meet the emergency, and could use, actually, in that case, general funds if he needed to meet an emergency. With respect to why not do it some other way, we did have a lot of discussion about doing it some other way. It seemed from the amount of resistance that was raised to having a gasoline tax that was just not going to be a productive approach. And frankly, if I had today to prioritize all the programs in the Department of Environmental Conservation, this one would be at the very bottom of the list. I think it is mostly a program that is a subsidy to businesses, and to some very large businesses at that. And I think if funds have to be cut from the general fund, this is an ideal candidate, in my opinion. And I don't support continuing to fund this program with general funds. So if this bill doesn't pass, I'll just put the committee on notice that will be my recommendation, to eliminate all general funding for this program in FY93. I don't feel that it's justified the way that it is. I get today questions from constituents who have home leaking tanks and wonder, how can we set up a program like the one we have when we do not help the homeowners? We have, and I guess the answer to that is, we're being driven by the federal government, which has led us into this program and established these requirements. I'm not convinced this is our highest environmental priority. I'm not convinced this is where all our money ought to go, but here we are. And I submit to you that under the circumstances, this is a reasonable way to pay for this program if you want to keep it going. If you don't want to keep it going, that's okay with me.
I'm going to go to teleconference now and take the first person on teleconference, William Hopkins.
I always favor the people.
William Hopkins, Executive Director of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association.
Oh, yeah, you bet.
Hale of his member companies conduct the majority of oil and gas exploration, production, and transportation activities in Alaska. And we appreciate this opportunity to express our position regarding ESHB 264 this afternoon. Strongly opposed for several important reasons. Would in effect impose a hidden but real tax increase on all oil production in Alaska, would impose unfair costs to the oil producers in the state to fund a program to correct underground storage tank problems over which they have no control and which are not associated with crude oil production. These costs are largely unknown, but could be potentially significant, on the thousands of various underground tanks throughout the state. It does not require the state to seek reimbursement costs of expenditures from responsible parties versus to consider alternatives and the potential impact of this legislation on the oil producers, and that the federal super reauthorization legislation enacted in 1986 as a provision to impose a 0.1 cent per gallon motor fuels excise tax as a revenue source to fund separate federal leaking underground storage tank fund. Under certain conditions, that fund could pay up to 90% of any state's costs for cleanup resulting from a discharge from an underground storage tank. To use that federal fund, Alaska may need to establish its own fund covering 10% corrective action costs, but the 470 fund believes it's not the appropriate source. In summary, the bill would place an unfair tax burden on oil producers to pay for problems related assumption. We urge the committee to reject. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Thank you, Mr. Hopkins. Are there questions? If not, Beverly Ward?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Beverly Ward. I'm Director of State Government Relations for ARCO, Alaska. We appreciate the opportunity to be here to express our views on House Bill 264. The 470 Fund was established in 1986. Its purpose was to ensure that there would always be an immediate source of money for the state to use to clean up a hazardous material spill. It is important to have such a fund in the event of a spill, so that in the event that the responsible party is unknown, or if he is unwilling or unable to assume responsibility for the cleanup. The fund was financed then by legislative appropriation, money received from federal, state, and other sources, money recovered from parties responsible for the cleanup of a specific site, and fines and penalties for damages recovered for costs incurred by the state. Following the 1989 Exxon Valdez spill, a special surcharge was imposed on the production of all oil. A nickel a barrel tax became the primary funding source for the 470 fund. The legislature provided for a suspension of the surcharge when the fund reached $50 million and for a reimposition of the surcharge when the fund balance fell below $50 million. The surcharge generates approximately $27 million a year. It'll probably come as no surprise to you that we are opposed to the expanded use of the 470 fund for the underground storage tank program or any other program. Our primary objections to House Bill 264 are as follows. The purpose of the 470 fund is to ensure that a source of money is readily available for the immediate cleanup of a hazardous material. The fund was not intended to be a funding source for preparatory or ongoing activities. Expanding the uses of the 470 fund to include ongoing payment for the underground storage tank program opens the floodgates for other inappropriate spending of the fund. Already there are proposals to use the fund for ferries for the marine highway system, public drinking water supplies, grants for local emergency planning commissions, and costs related to the air quality program. When will we recognize and abide by the original purpose of the fund? Where does it stop all these other needs? Secondly, the expanded use of the 470 fund is a tax on the oil industry. The $50 million cap on the surcharge is meaningless if we continue to expand the uses of the fund. Through fiscal year 93, the oil producers will have paid over $110 million into this fund. If the state continues to raid the fund, it creates uncertainty about whether the nickel per barrel will later have to be increased. Third, the major producers who pay for over 90% of this tax have no direct relationship to the underground storage tank program. In the case of ARCO, we have exactly two underground storage tanks in this state. One of those is in the ARCO building in downtown Anchorage, and it is currently being dug up and replaced by an above-ground tank. So we are not going to be benefiting in any way from this program. Fourth, the nickel a barrel tax is imposed on all production in the state. It is one more hurdle that any new producer in Alaska must overcome. Finally, the failure to reach the $50 million cap caused by the expansion of uses of the fund is an additional tax on the industry at a time when oil production and oil revenues are beginning to decline. Increased exploration is extremely important to Alaska and to the industry if we are to offset the dramatic production decline of Prudhoe Bay in the near future. There have been several proposals this year to offer exploration drilling incentives to the industry, but it makes no sense to offer the oil industry exploration incentive credits on one hand and to introduce major disincentives and major uncertainty through a bill like House Bill 264 on the other hand. It's the major oil producers who will be exploring the most aggressively for new oil, and it's the major producers who will be making the investments in technology and capital projects to enhance oil production in the aging Prudhoe Bay, and it'll be the major oil producers who are paying for this tax and this program. We are sympathetic to your problems. We understand that you are dealing with a mandate that is real. The cost is expensive. The deadline is nearing, and we sympathize with you. But we urge you to consider other ways to fund this program and to reduce the negative impact of this legislation. And the only other comment I would have to make, I think, is off the record, and I would hope that someday Representative Kopanen buys some Exxon stock. I have copies of my testimony for you.
Representative McClain. I mean, Holman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. If this isn't a fair question, you can say no.
It's not a fair question.
I'm just curious if you have a suggestion about how to pay for it instead of this mechanism, because I think everybody agrees it's a problem that ought to be fixed, but I'm very concerned about it just coming out of the general fund, given how many other things we can no longer afford. So I don't know if you have any suggestions, either based on your experience observing how it works in other states or whatever.
It's a deadly question for me, because no matter how I suggest it should be funded, I will have a group of constituents out there that are beating up on me like they're beating up on you guys. So I'm not sure that I can win by doing that. In many other states, it's paid for by a motor fuels tax, so that there's a little bit of a direct relationship between a refined product, gasoline, and the purchasers of that refined product. So that is certainly one option, a motor fuels tax, use it for that. And it doesn't necessarily have to be an increase maybe in the motor fuels tax, but just, you know, a program receipts kind of thing. Or if the governor's dedicated highway fund should be used for that, and I don't know whether that legislation is going to pass. There may be other funding sources. I don't know, and I'm really throwing this out because I don't know the answer to this one myself, but we're going on the assumption that EPA says that we don't have an appropriate funding source because it's a general fund source. Has anybody challenged that statement of EPA?
I could challenge it. We don't have enough money in.
So I wish I had a wonderful solution for you, Representative Ulmer.
Thank you. Ms. Ward, John Ringstead. Representative.
Any words to say to us? Like the speaker says, the words of wisdom.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Ringstead. I represent BP Exploration Alaska. David Pritchard, who's our Senior Vice President, wanted to make a statement. He's unable to be here today, so he's asked me to come and read the letter that I've given you a copy of. As Senior Vice President of BP Exploration Alaska, Inc., with responsibility for the Poudre Bay Field, I am writing to express BP's concern about the new proposals under consideration to expand the uses of the Oil Spill Response Fund, 470 Fund, under AS 4608010. The principal source of funding for the 470 Fund is a nickel-a-barrel oil conservation surcharge to the production tax under AS 4355-200-240. Under these statutes, the surcharge is to be suspended when the balance of the 470 fund exceeds $50 million and is to be temporarily reimposed and needed as needed to replenish the fund to $50 million when its balance falls below that level. When the conservation surcharge was enacted as part of the oil package, a package of oil spill legislation in 1989, the fiscal notes for that legislation indicated that the revenues from the surcharge through FY92 would be enough to cover the additional demands on the 470 fund for over 25 years. However, since 1989, several new uses have been created for the 470 fund. These new uses have delayed the time when the surcharge goes into suspension and will shorten the time it will be suspended before being needed to replenish the fund. To date, more than $60 million have been paid under the surcharge. If enacted, the new uses being proposed for the 470 fund would ensure that the conservation surcharge will continue indefinitely. Rather than being a limited duration surcharge to raise $50 million to be readily available for the state to respond to a spill, the conservation surcharge begins to look like a permanent tax increase aimed at the exploration and production industry. We are striving to reduce costs as much as we can at Poudre Bay and other North Slope fields consistent with safe and prudent operations. The ongoing decline in production means we cannot afford to let costs rise, nor even let them remain flat. Only by actively reducing our costs of operating will we be able to develop and recover the full potential of the resources on the slope. Making the oil conservation surcharge a permanent tax increase runs counter to the need to reduce costs. And although it may seem modest, it will probably be viewed inside and outside the oil industry as a sign of instability in Alaska's tax structure. We are not questioning the need to clean up leaking underground storage tanks, nor are we doubting the merits of the other uses that have been proposed for the 470 Fund. The worthiness of these environmental initiatives is not the issue. The issue is whether Alaska needs to raise oil taxes in order to address these issues. We at BP believe it is neither necessary nor prudent to raise oil taxes at this time. Very truly yours, David Pritchard.
Is there a question from Mr. Inkstead?
Thank you.
Representative Boyer.
I'm just kind of curious, Mr. Chairman, how the dollar divides, what the division is for the dollar. John, if you maybe know, or Beverly, how's the dollar divided here between the oil companies? For every buck that goes in, who's paying what?
I guess I'll take my first shot at that. It's based just a nickel a barrel on production in terms of how many barrels you produce as which percent you do. Each field is set up to where the ownership, percentage-wise, of the different companies that own it are allocated X number of barrels. So at Prudhoe Bay, BP owns 1%. At Kaparuk, we own another percent. Endicott, we own another percent. It's like that. So you just total out the number of barrels, just like our royalties. Add up your number of barrels and multiply the nickels.
So who's producing the most barrels? Who's the biggest hit against
BP?
BP.
We're doing about
Anarko, then Exxon.
We're doing. I think BP is doing about half.
Okay. Thanks.
Thank you.
Kenneth Reeder.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, representing three members of the committee. Can you hear me okay?
You need to turn that mic on. Flip it up. There you go.
Can you hear me now?
No, okay. Bill. We're on teleconference. We can hear you. It's fine.
I have, members of the committee, I have some prepared testimony that I would ask that be passed out. The prepared testimony covers an awful lot of the same ground, and I'd really not like to bore you with saying the same things over and over again, because Exxon does support the testimony of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association and that of BP and ARCO. I would just like to emphasize that with respect to the 470 fund, that with Alaska oil production declining and coupled with the current soft oil market, now is not the time for another tax increase on the oil industry. As we've previously testified and other members of the industry have testified, it's tax stability that is crucial to the future of the oil industry in Alaska. Now, in the case of the specific problem the House Bill 264 is intending to address, I've attached as a part of the testimony a paper that was done by the American Petroleum Institute generally examining the problem of how one funds the state funds that are necessary to support the federal program. And it calls for various mechanisms, principally general fund, and which I understand, you know, the reluctance on the part of some to do, but it also calls for piggybacking on the motor fuel tax. We believe that there are, you know, these other sources are much more appropriate than the 470 fund, which we equate with another tax increase. And those are my only comments.
Other questions? I just have one. How about if we change something that's currently a draw on the 470 fund, or is projected to be a draw on the 470 fund, and replace it with this program? Would you then have as much opposition?
There have been five bills passed since in the last 2 years, 1990 and 1991, further expanding the uses of the 470 fund. As to the merits of any one of the individual programs, I really would hesitate to say trade this one for that one.
Thank you.
And by the way, we're about 20% of the share, and we have zero underground storage tanks in Alaska.
Thank you. Is there anyone else on teleconference who wanted to testify on the bill? Is there anyone else in the room who wanted to testify on the bill?
Executive Director of the Board of Storage Tank Assistance.
Thank you. Please proceed.
And strongly supports the committee substitute for House Bill 264. To make a couple of very brief comments, many of you have already seen our written testimony
in the past. This is not a tax increase. This bill does not increase the already existing tax. I think we'd be naive to assume that this Nicola bill has not already been passed on to the consumers. I should point out that the 470 fund has been used to respond to leaking underground storage tanks in the past when there is not a responsible party to pay the cost of cleanup. At this time, with this present grant program that's being administered by the Ford Storage Tank Assistance and the Department of Environmental Conservation, we're able to help owners clean up their sites when they have leaking tanks, and we're also able to keep them in business. Through the existing uses of the 470 fund, and if an owner cannot pay the cost to clean up his leaking tank site, the department comes in and cleans up that site using 470 funds and using it under the pretext of spill response, and then sends the owner a bill. If the owner cannot pay that cost, the facility essentially goes bankrupt, the owner is out of business, and the state is left holding the tab. This program allows the use of the 470 fund, or I should say committee substitute for 264 allows the use of the 470 fund so that we can keep these owners and operators in business. This is a program to keep the mom and pops, the small-time groceries and mini marts. There's a large number of them in the state. 90% of our gas stations facilities are owned by smaller businesses, not by large oil companies. And this bill and this program is designed to assist them meet the federal mandate as well as protect the public health and the environment. Leaking tanks are not the result of negligence by owners and operators. Leaking tanks are caused by just normal corrosion processes, by accidents, by a number of different things which are beyond the control of hardworking businesses within the state. The environmental compliance is very difficult for most of these owners and operators to bear. It's very difficult for a small mom-and-pop station out on the Glen Highway to pay $150 an hour to an environmental consultant and then be faced with, say, a $400,000 cleanup followed by possible $40,000 fines or some such ridiculous number that's being given to them by the EPA. This program allows these owners and operators to deal with those environmental concerns, to protect their neighbors' drinking water supplies, and to stay in business and remain as contributing and beneficial and economic contributors to the state. I strongly support this bill. The board strongly supports this bill. We think this is an excellent way to fund the program. We feel that it is consistent with existing uses of the 470 fund, probably more consistent than many of the other uses. These are pollution prevention and spill response activities that are within the existing scope of the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Response Fund. I do encourage the members to pass the committee substitute for House Bill 264 on. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Copeland.
Thank you. Actually, I'm referring to the paper that was given in by Mr. Rader from the American Petroleum Institute. The comments on piggybacking on motor fuels are something that, if we do see the governor's proposal for a constitutionally dedicated fund, or even if we have a statutory dedicated fund on motor fuels tax, I'm bearing in mind that the legislature might sometime in the future decide to back off from the 470 fund or come up to some other solution, it would be necessary to make sure that that legislation or constitutional amendment does allow this as an option. But that's for the future rather than the current.
Representative Larson, first let me ask, is there anyone else in the room who wanted to testify on the bill? If not, the public hearing is closed. Representative Larson.
Yeah, it was just going to be a quick question to the person who just testified. If the funding source for this bill was a motor fuel tax, would you still favor the legislation?
To answer that question, difficult right now. We have been advised by the Department of Transportation member on our board that they feel that a tax on motor fuels should be prioritized for highway improvement. We feel that the board would like to see some other means or alternative means of funding this program. However, based on the time that is required to push such a tax through the possible controversy and also the the deadlines that are imminent between EPA, we feel that a tax is not the appropriate method at this time. However, we would certainly like to investigate or at least participate in looking at a tax for the future use of the fund, but future, a future use of funding this program. But for the interim, at this time, 264 appears to be the most illogical and appropriate use.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Further discussion on the bill? Chair? Any further discussions on the bill? It's the pleasure of the committee.
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we pass out the CS for HB 264 resources with individual recommendations.
Object.
Representative Barnes, you're out of order. Why don't we wait until he finishes his motion?
I thought it was finished.
Representative Boyer.
And the accompanying fiscal note.
Object.
There's objection from Representative Barnes.
Voice.
Is there discussion? Secretary, please call the roll.
Representative Kopanen?
The burden that has led to the voice, yes.
Representative Larson?
No.
Representative Phillips?
No.
Representative Sharp?
Nope.
Representative Ulmer?
Yes.
Representative Boyer?
Yes.
Representative Barnes?
Nope.
Representative Brown?
Yes.
Representative Jackal?
No.
Representative Barr?
Yes.
Representative McLean?
No.
Motion fails. Bill will remain in committee. Next bill we'll take up is HGR 70. Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, are we in teleconference for this resolution? Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I introduced House Joint Resolution 70, actually introduced in the 16th legislature and generated some interest, but it's introduced it again this year, and it's this concept of providing for some additional tax breaks for families with children is getting quite a bit of attention in Congress, and my resolution, just as a way of attacking this problem and providing for better equity in the distribution of our tax liability. I prepared a written statement that you have in the packet. I'm not going to read it in the interest of time. I'd be happy to answer questions. I will say that we addressed some of the concerns of some members in the House Hess Committee, and most of the questions dealt with the statistics that I've presented, and while I believe they are correct, out of the Census Bureau records, there it's easy to get confused about accuracy of numbers, and I know that Representative Ulmer had some questions, and she may want to address those. I'd be happy to address any questions the committee might have, any comments.
Representative Ulmer.
Mr. Chairman, I support the resolution. I was a little concerned by some of the statistics because they seem to conflict with information which is available in a booklet called Leave No Child Behind by the Children's Trust Fund, and I did make a copy for the members of just one page from the Children's Trust Fund statistics, which refer to the increase in married mothers in the workforce jumping from 48% to 66%. The amendment that you have in front of you would add a new whereas clause and delete two existing whereas clauses. The purpose for adding the whereas clause on page one is to recognize what is happening in terms of economic conditions, and I believe the sponsor has no objection. As a matter of fact, he and I have worked on this language, and I think that's not a problem. The second half of the amendment, which on page two deletes lines four through seven, this is the reason for my concern. If you read the three whereas clauses on page two and add them up, you get 47% plus 8% plus 5%, and you'd read that and you'd sort of say, well, does that mean 60% of all children have mothers in this condition? And then you look at this Children's Defense Fund statistics and read that 66% of mothers in the labor force
You know, it leaves you with kind of an unclear picture of what reality is. So I would the other thing is the information from the Family Research Council, which is in your packet, that talk about 47% have a non-employed mother and then 5% are cared for by mom while she earns income. You know, it's a little confusing. That might be part of the 47. It, you know, some part of it may be part of the 47. So I don't know. I would feel more comfortable with the resolution if those two whereas clauses on the top of page 2 were deleted, and so I would move the amendment.
The would be the two whereases, second two whereases on page 2, right?
That's correct.
Their objection to the amendment. Representative Kopner.
Lines 4, 2, or lines 5 and 6 only, or
four, five,
because
seven,
it doesn't make sense on the copy that I have here.
It's on committee, the Hess committee substitute.
Oh, okay.
And it would be page 2, lines 4 through 7. And add the language on page 1, line 1.
No, I had the wrong one was on top.
Their objection to the amendment, right. Representative Phillips.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to have the sponsor's remarks. How he feels about it since this legislation.
Representative Lynn.
Mr. Chairman, the problem with the statistics and the application is that in the resolution we talk about the percentage of children, and those indeed can be additive, and you can conclude that 60% of children have either a mother that's caring for them in the home who is not otherwise working, or mother in the home who is working some type of home industry or has a father in the home. But the problem comparing is that this other statistic that Representative Ulmer referred to deals with the mother. And so we're talking about percentage of children in one, and the other talks about the percentage of the mothers. And so I believe that it actually adds to the strength of the resolution to leave it in, because we're talking about 60% of children who can be impacted by and benefited by a change in the tax code. So that there's the for me the benefit of leaving it in. I can see how it would be. It's understandable to me how it can be interpreted another way. But I've spent some time looking at it while you're dealing with the other legislation just prior to this, and I believe we provided to the committee the documentation that has this report called "Who's Minding the Kids." I've gone through the numbers. It's and added them up. The percentages add up to 100%, so the concern about whether there's overlap in different categories, I believe, is taken into account. We've taken the raw numbers and come up with percentages. So I think the percentages are correct, and the resolution with those numbers is accurate.
Thank you, Mr. Lehman. Is there a further question? Have they been able to get a hold of him?
I got a hold of him. He hasn't called in yet.
Representative Kopner.
Yes, I think trying to fit two sets of statistics together without a common grounding, speaking in one term on the head of the mother and the other on the children, it does result in mixing apples and oranges. And I'm just thinking of the days during the Depression when my father had to look for underpaid day labor and my mother worked as a domestic and took me along to polish the silverware. So I don't know where I would have fit in that statistic either. So I think I would support the amendment just to simplify, if not clarify.
Further discussion on the amendment.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if the sponsor feels strong about it, I think you ought to leave it. And frankly, I think the President of the United States and these other congressional guys are just going to read lines 12 through 18, and that'll be it. Find out what the resolution is all about. I mean, how many times do we read every single resolution that comes in from local government or the villages or the school boards?
We don't control school boards or city councils or things like that, but we certainly do
exercise some control over what comes out of this body, and I think that's, whether the sponsor likes it or not, we change things all the time that the sponsor opposes. That's the prerogative of the body, and you know, I felt sort of strongly about that last bill. It stayed in committee, so.
Well, I'm sure it will come back again, Mr. Chairman. Always have. It's like a...
Okay, we have a Bill Maddox on teleconference at the request of the sponsor. Mr. Maddox.
Yes.
Representative Lehman.
Bill, this is Lauren Lehman. We have an amendment before the committee. We're in the House Finance Committee right now, and the proposal is to delete the two whereas clauses that refer to the 8% of American children under 5 who are cared by both parents who work shifts and share the care, and the next clause that says that 5% of children have mothers working for pay at home. The concern of the proposer of the amendment is that these statistics don't mesh with other statistics that she has, showing that 60% or more of married mothers are in the workforce. I have just commented, and I don't think that you were online and may have heard it, that I believe these numbers are correct, and I've gone back through the Census Bureau report to confirm that, but the confusion arises when we look at, we're trying to compare the percentages of children and percentages of mothers. I guess what we'd like to have from you is just confirmation or maybe some clarification on the correctness of these statistics that are presented in the resolution.
Yes, Mr. Maddox, could we also get you just to state your name for the record, and if you would care, I mean, I don't know where you're from or who you are, other than you're from Washington, D.C. I'd like to know a little bit about your background so we know what type of credibility to put to the testimony.
I'll be happy to do that. My name is William R. Maddox, Jr. I'm the Director of Policy Analysis for the Family Research Council in Washington. We're a research and advocacy group based in Washington that has been very involved in the last 7 years in tax relief legislation at the federal level, as well as child care legislation. And so by virtue of that, we are quite familiar with Census Bureau statistics on daycare arrangements, Bureau of Labor statistics numbers on labor force participation by men and women with children. Congressman Lehman contacted us a couple of weeks ago to confirm some numbers that he was including in the resolution. We consulted the 1919 Census Bureau report, Who's Minding Children, or I believe it's actually Who's Minding the Kids. And the data that he included in the original resolution, and that is still in the resolution, is indeed accurate. I think, as Representative Lehman indicated, the confusion over these numbers comes from the difference between measuring children and measuring women. If you consider the question, what proportion of the population of mothers are employed in the labor force, you do get numbers in the 50-70% range, depending on how exactly you ask the question and whether or not children, what age of children you're considering and that sort of thing. If, however, you look at the percentage of children who are in various care arrangements, what you find is that roughly 60% of all children are cared for by either a non-employed mother or by a mother who is employed while caring for her children. The most obvious example of someone in this category would be a woman who takes in other people's children for pay, caring labor statistics considers her an employed mother. Likewise, there is a category of 8% where mom may be employed in the evenings or on weekends in a part-time job, and while she is earning income, dad, who has worked a 9-to-5 job, will provide care for the children in the evenings or weekends. So it's important to make these kinds of distinctions depending on what the policy question is before a particular legislative body. If the issue is of a concern to how children are cared for, child care policy, things of that nature, then it makes sense to ask the question in terms of percentage of children. If the question before the legislative body really is more of a question about labor force participation of mothers, then obviously the BLS data is of greater value. But I think that's the reason for the discrepancy, just depending on whether you're talking about mothers and about children. And I should
recognize what it's like.
We find when a mother has a first child, her tendency to leave the labor force entirely is not as great as it is when she has subsequent children. So it follows then that when you look at the percentages of children, you'll find more children being cared for by a non-employed mother than you will find proportions of women in that kind of situation.
Thank you. Is there questions? Is that data from the Census Bureau?
It is data from the Census Bureau. It's taken from tables A and B of the 1990 report, Who's Minding the Kid, which is the most recent report on child care practices in this country.
Representative Ulmer.
Thank you for joining us. I think my major problem in terms of trying to reconcile 66% of married mothers in the labor force with the 60% of children at home with their mothers has been largely answered by your comments. I really hadn't thought about the fact that mothers who are at home probably have more children than mothers who are in the workforce. That would be sort of interesting to get some actual numbers on, but I guess it's a plausible assumption. And so, you know, I think it answers a lot of the ambiguity that appeared in my mind when I looked at these numbers, because they're so different than the numbers that I've seen, both nationally and here in Alaska. And in Alaska, we've also recently learned that 63% of mothers with children are in the workforce in Alaska, and that just seems so inconsistent with this resolution. But I understand the point you're making about the difference between looking at mothers versus the difference of looking at children, and I thank you.
We have faced this question quite often because there is, I think, a natural assumption made when you look at the proportions of employed mothers that you will then find similar proportions of children in those kinds of arrangements. And one thing that also, I think, enters into the discrepancy is this fact. The way in which the Bureau of Labor Statistics defines employment is quite broad. A woman can be considered an employed mother if she does as little as 1 hour of paid work during the week, or if she, for that matter, engages in 15 or more hours of unpaid work on a family farm. So you end up having a lot of women who I think would probably consider themselves stay-at-home moms, if you will, but who by virtue of the fact that they, you know, write an article and get a small stipend for doing so, or end up, babysitting and earning a couple of dollars from a friend or something, those people end up being considered employed mothers for purposes of Labor Department numbers, when in fact, one could question whether or not that's such an accurate term. Obviously, I'm not at all suggesting that that is a typical arrangement, or that that in any way represents the vast majority of employed mothers. I'm simply suggesting that the definition of employment is sufficiently broad to take everything from a mother employed 1 hour to a mother employed 60 hours a week, and there's obviously going to be very different child care arrangements for those two extremes.
From D.C.
Is there further questions?
Mr. Chairman, I'll go back to the amendment and remove my portion of the amendment which deletes the two clauses and just include the new whereas clause.
Okay, Representative Lehman.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem with that, but I would like, and I haven't had a chance to discuss this with Representative Ulmer before, but when I was sitting here, I saw one other thing that perhaps we can add on and just take care of it in one amendment. On page 2, line 13, where we say, be it resolved to amend the Internal Revenue Code to increase the personal exemption, I suggest inserting the words, for children under 18. The intent of this is to provide this for children. This is what the President proposed in his address to Congress, and I believe this is what Congress is working on. While I believe it would be delightful to increase it for all of us, the purpose of this specific resolution is to address the particular challenge with families and those with children. So I would suggest that if we can consider that a friendly amendment.
I'll include it in my amendment.
Not that friendly, it's all of us.
Are there objections? The amendment, there, okay, the first part of the amendment, is that what we're dealing with now, or?
Right, the new whereas clause plus the
The new whereas clause plus the, for children under 18, suggested by Representative Lehman. Is there objection to the first part of the amendment? Without objection, that has been adopted. The second amendment is delete on page 2, lines 4 through line 7. Is there discussion?
I'm withdrawing that.
That has been withdrawn. Is there objection? Without objection, it's a pleasure of the committee. Yes, the bill just have to stay.
Him up, move him out.
Well,
Mr. Chairman,
has to make a motion. Representative Boyer.
I'll move that we pass out the CS for HGR 70 with individual recommendations.
Finance CS for
and the company 0 this one.
Is there objection? Without objection, it moves from committee. Next bill we'll take up is House Bill 155. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm asking to have distributed an amendment. Are we on teleconference?
We are on teleconference. A couple of people listening.
Right. For the purpose of answering questions, I understand. An amendment suggested by the Department of Commerce, and there is a representative from Commerce here that can speak to the substance of this amendment. As the committee will recall, we did have a hearing on this bill, which would be a first step toward meeting the state's responsibility to implement the Americans with Disabilities Act. The purpose in getting this new draft CS that's before you now was to separate the no-interest loan fund to private businesses from the grant fund for public entities and nonprofits. That has been done in this draft. Another change that's made in the draft, and I believe you have a memo in your packet dated March 6th that outlines these changes, is to make it the legislature that would appropriate money based on the prioritization done by the Governor's Committee on Employment of People with Disabilities. And again, what we're trying to do is involve the people who are most directly affected in the decisions of allocating where we want to put our dollars for addressing the ADA requirements. The third change provides that there would be one comprehensive set of regulations done by the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities and the Department of Commerce in consultation with the Governor's Committee. Fourth, we added some loan evaluation criteria and also grant evaluation criteria. That's at page 5, and those criteria are listed there in the memo. And fifth, we made some changes in the timing of how these projects would come in and be considered. After getting this draft back, we did share it with the departments that are affected, and that is what resulted in the new amendment that I've just passed out. And if I might call on Mr. Richard from the Department of Commerce to briefly explain this. He has put together a $6,900 fiscal note for development of the regulations and has an amendment drafted. And if you could just briefly explain the purpose of the amendment.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, my name is Martin Richard. I'm the Director of the Division of Investments with the Department of Commerce and Economic Development. The amendments basically is a request to show intent that the loans be collateralized and be secured loans and the regulations would cover exactly what collateral would be acceptable. The sections referring to the reserve account would allow the department to reserve a certain amount of money in order to recover assets. A lot of times, if you're in a second deed of trust position, you have to take out that first deed of trust in order to recover anything from the collateral. The section referring to the disposal of assets that are taken by foreclosure or default is to allow us to take assets like that and to dispose of them in any manner that is in the best interest of the state, which would include financing of the property if that would be necessary. Those two sections are sections that are covered in the majority of the loan programs that we administer presently. The fiscal note itself deals with our involvement in the regulation process only, and we've not looked at the cost of servicing the loan portfolio since it hasn't been determined the size or the quantity of loans that are going to be made under this program.
Thank you. Are there questions? Do you want to move the amendment?
I would like to move adoption of the work draft that is before you.
There are objections?
3-5.
Is there objections to adopting the work draft 3592? Without objection, we have the work draft before us. Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, I'd move adoption of the amendment dated 3-6 that was just described.
Representative Phillips.
Question. We just got the amendment about 3 minutes. 3 minutes ago. Was this, Kate, was this an amendment that Commerce came in and just noticed some deficiencies in the bill? Or how's the amendment?
The amendment, Mr. Chairman, Representative Phillips, resulted from us separating the loan program and putting it over in Commerce.
Okay.
And they saw the work draft yesterday, and Mr. Richards proposed these, which are, as he said, common provisions for other loan funds. This is not a big thing. I mean, we could do it later, but I thought since it was here and he was here, and it would be better to get it clean and together. And I'll say I've had a couple of conversations with members about, given the fiscal situation, whether it makes sense to be starting a new program that subsidizes business at this time. I just point out that the bill in this form does not put any money in this loan fund, nor in the grant fund either. And I've had some discussions with the governor's office. I believe they will be putting it into the capital budget at some level. And I think that it does make sense to go ahead and establish a loan fund. I think it's the smallest businesses that would be the most affected, and that a small amount of money could go a long way and be used again since it is a revolving fund. But this does not obligate us to capitalize it at any level. I think we do have some obligations as a state, as I've said before. I think we need to make a good faith effort to address it, and I believe we'll see some proposal come forward, I hope soon, from the administration about the level that they feel can be supported in light of all our other demands and priorities.
Further objection?
The only reason I ask is so I normally get my bill packets in the morning, and I like to spend a little time to think about things.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a word, a question of the sponsor. Is there one fund that both the grants and the possible loans would come out of?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Sharp, there's two funds. There's the Remodeling Assistance Fund and the Remodeling Grant Application for Remodeling Grants and Loans. And, well, it's called the Barrier-Free Remodeling Loan Fund. That's on page 3 at line 8. And then
copy. The governor, if he has any funds to put in, he could choose to put it in just the grant for public buildings and so forth, rather than it getting confused with where it goes.
We will specify in any future legislation where money goes.
Is there a further objection to the amendment? Representative Larson.
Oh, to the amendment, no.
Okay, if not, the amendment is adopted. Representative Larson.
I just had a general question on this committee, the Employment of People with Disabilities. Is that an existing committee, or is this piece of legislation creating that committee?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Larson, that's an existing committee. It is expanded by this legislation, but it does exist now. It has... they work in the employment area of trying to enhance and expand employment opportunities for people with disabilities. That language is on page 2, beginning at line, well, actually, it begins in section 1, where we have the purpose of the committee described and expanded to include this purpose, and then the expansion of the members on page 2.
It's in the Department of Labor budget.
Okay, so this will expand it to 12 members, plus the ex officio ones. The only comment I had in relation to that question, Mr. Chairman, was with the task force on boards and commissions, with the number of committees that are being eliminated or consolidated, I was just wondering if there's another committee that could already do this, but if this is the present or existing committee, I remove my objections here.
The committee is not actually being expanded.
It's still 12 members. It's just designating who they are, isn't it? No?
Correct.
It's designating a new purpose for an existing committee. I do believe the governor's office has some suggestions about combining them, but I haven't seen this particular one.
I wasn't able to make the meeting the other day, Mr. Chairman, when they came up with their list of recommendations, but I do have a copy, so I'm curious enough to go look it up to see where it's at now.
This is what?
Further discussion on the bill.
Let's move it.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we pass out the finance CS for House Bill 155 with individual recommendations and with the accompanying fiscal notes.
Is there objection? Without objection, the bill moves from committee. Having nothing further to come before the committee today, we are... Monday morning.